and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie, and joining us today is Bruegel's director, Jeremin Zettelmeyer, and from the International Finance Corporation, the Vice President for Europe and Latin America, Alfonso Garcia Mora. The IFC is part of the World Bank Group and is very active in helping the world find the financing it needs to meet the challenges of various transitions that are in progress and other important goals. Alfonso, can you tell us what IFC is doing these days and how it fits into this broader theme of making these development banks serve the world that we're in and not the one that they were created for?
Thank you very much, first of all, for inviting me to participate in this conversation with Jeremin. It's a big pleasure for me. So whenever you ask anybody about the times that we are living, we always think that we are living in a complicated times. No? But I really believe that this time is kind of different because, you know, there are many factors, internal and external factors, that come together to make us think differently on many dimensions, no? Including the MDBs. No? The multilateral development banks, you know, were created for some specific purpose 80 years ago. And the situation, as you said, is very different. But the challenges are huge going forward and require some coordination and multilateral solutions. No? Because the problems are global problems, are not problems that are just tailored to one specific sector, to one specific country, are really problems that are global, that therefore require broader solutions. No? And there is where the World Bank Group, as a member of the Bretton Woods institutions, together with the IMF, comes into play. No? And IFC as the private sector arm of the World Bank Group. No? Just to give you a sense, IFC, we are around 5,000 people deployed all over the countries, together with the World Bank in the world. And we invest and mobilize private capital for around $60 billion yearly. So that's the role that we play, which is trying to advance and move and help the private sector to develop and therefore to help countries to achieve the development goals that they have.
And can you tell us what sorts of goals those are? Is that in terms of improving infrastructure, reducing poverty, creating jobs? Like, what are we trying to help countries do?
Yeah, so basically the IFC serves the same mission that the World Bank, which is end poverty and in a livable planet. So basically it's a combination of objectives. I mean, we have to think that there are still 700 million people that live under or below the extreme poverty line. And another 3.5 billion people that live with less than $6.8 a day. So 50% of the population in the world, 50% more or less, big numbers, live with less than $6 a day. But you know, the numbers that we get at the bank is that in the next 10-12 years, there will be 1.2 billion young people coming into the workforce globally, 1.2 billion. And you know, the trend and the trends and the normal forecast will tell us that we can create around 400 million jobs in MDs. So basically what you have is that we will be able to generate, if we do things as we are doing today, one third of the jobs that will be needed. So that's a big challenge. And the issue is, okay, what can we do in order to help countries to create these jobs? And what are the things that we are working on in order to help countries delivering on this agenda? Four things. One, working on what we call the foundational infrastructure and human capital. I mean, we know that jobs is a supply and demand issue. No? It's not just a question of working from the demand side or from the supply side. We need to have the human capital. We need to prepare. We need to help countries to prepare their citizens with the skills that are needed. And human capital doesn't mean only formal education. Means skills. Means providing with what actually the private sector needs in order to generate jobs. 70% of the jobs in the world are generated by the private sector. So you need to strengthen those skills that the private sector is demanding to continue growing. No? Foundational infrastructure, what I mean is basic infrastructure. Many of these countries do not have the basic infrastructure to actually think about roads, think about ports, think about energy, think about water, think about basic infrastructure. So this is kind of the foundational part in order to generate jobs. Second is trying to focus and invest on those sectors that are critical on job creation. And we have identified a few of them. No? You could think about agriculture, for instance, especially in Africa, but you can also think about tourism, especially in middle-income countries and upper-middle-income countries. You can think about manufacturing in some countries as well. So think about the sectors that actually are more intense on jobs and how we can help them, again, from a public and private sector, to make it happen. No? Third point would be business environment, no? Which is something that the World Bank has traditionally worked. No? How to create the investment climate, the business environment to promote jobs. And the fourth point, and last, and I will stop here, is what we call private capital mobilization. So we need to mobilize private capital. And why do we believe that private capital mobilization should be at the core of our strategy? Because of two reasons. One, if you want the quantitative one, there is no fiscal space in many governments to actually do the investments that are required in order to create all these conditions that I mentioned before. But second, because it is very clear that actually when you mobilize private capital and when you bring private capital, if you have the right conditions and foundational conditions in terms, again, competition, rule of law, etc., you can really create a multiplier effect that is much bigger than if you do this with public funding. No? So that's why we are at the World Bank Group bringing together much closer the public sector solutions with private sector solutions and what we call the knowledge bank, which is really trying to move knowledge from one place to the other and looking at the peers that are relevant for each of the countries. No? Thinking Brazil, their peers, probably are not in Latin America, or one or two might be in Latin America, but they might be more interested in knowing how other countries, I don't know, Turkey, South Africa, Indonesia, India, what they are doing. So the role of the World Bank Group is also to make sure that these good practices and lessons learned can be moved from one country to another.
Super interesting. And thank you for walking us through that, the way that capacity building works, as well as the financing. German, you've been in Europe. You come from the International Monetary Fund. So you have, or at least as part of your experience, so you have experience with how these Bretton Woods institutions work. Where do you see Europe's new push into development finance going? And how does that fit into the architecture that we've been building over the last decades?
If you allow me, I'm going to start by maybe commenting a bit on what Alfonso said. Perhaps also answering from my perspective this question of, you know, how are institutions useful? How should they adapt that have been, in a sense, created for a different world?
And so the way that I would summarize it is that the point of departure for these institutions, particularly those that were created at the beginning, meaning at Bretton Woods, and shortly thereafter, so in the aftermath of World War II, was a world which was characterized by internationalism that shortly thereafter changed by having the East-West divide, but we still had internationalism within the two halves of the world, and of course these institutions then became part of the Western half of the so-called free world. And then the other thing that was characteristic at the time is there was an incredibly pronounced north-south divide, right? So global GDP was almost entirely produced in Europe and in North America, and then, you know, to some extent in Japan, but Japan was destroyed. And, you know, many countries that are now the members of the IMF and the World Bank did not even exist then. They were sort of part of colonial empires. So we went from there to decolonization, and, you know, until I would say the 1990s, the North-South divide was really what was keeping us up, right? There were enormous gaps in living standards, and there was a sense that we had to actively overcome these gaps through development efforts. And that, you know, these institutions, particularly the World Bank, would be at the forefront of doing that. What we subsequently saw was incredibly fast catch-up, you know, in part with the help of institutions like the World Bank, particularly in East Asia.
All right. So there was the East Asian miracle, and then there was the Chinese miracle, and these were driven largely by international trade. And so we're now in a different world where the North, the old North, controls a much smaller size of global GDP. We have had demonstration effects of how very poor countries like Korea can become very rich in advance in a relatively short time period. And we have the giant China that is there. And that has changed the entire dynamics. And it has changed it in two ways. It has, narrowed that gap between North and the so-called global South that China is part of still, even though it still exists in per capita income terms. But it has also, threatened the former North and West and its monopoly on the global economy and its power. It's created new geopolitical rivalry, and it has created a new wave of economic nationalism that we had hoped to overcome after the war that was there in the 1930s, leading to tariffs, immigration restrictions, trade wars, FDI restrictions, and so forth, and so that is what really poses challenges for those institutions. And so, in what sense are they still relevant, or how do they make the best of this world? So I think there are two factors. One is that for large parts of the world, the old paradigm, which is that, development is difficult, trade may not be enough. You need those foundational investments that Alfonso was talking about, meaning human capital and infrastructure. It's still true. It's true for, Latin America, large parts. It's true for some European countries, for many African countries, obviously, and some countries in Asia. So the old mechanic, I think, of development in updated form, particularly with higher roles for human capital, is still there. And indeed, one of the reasons why we have this geopolitical competition is because the new superpowers understand that and want to get into the game of political influence by helping the further behind developing countries overcome this. The other reason why these institutions continue to be so important is because we've discovered new global public goods in the meantime, which weren't really on our mind in 1945 and 46. And so that is mainly climate and nature. And so that is, of course, a very important part of their work. And the tension that we have is that these are also the areas of cooperation that are most threatened by economic nationalism. And so it's a tough job of having to finesse it, but it basically means that MDBs, which are somewhat less political, somewhat less symbolic than, for example, an organization that has to fight for free trade, and where in principle development objectives, particularly when they do not involve very large amounts of bilateral funding, right? The funding is already committed. There is a broad consensus for these development objectives that is essentially robust to ideology. And so this is why I think, we not only need these institutions today, but they can actually survive and play a useful role in this much more polarized environment. And then, I've talked enough. I can talk about the European perspective and Europe's role maybe separately, but back to you first, Rebecca.
Yeah, well, I would like it if both of you could anchor that context in where Europe is now. Particularly, Europe is trying to strengthen its relations with Latin America and with other countries that are neither China nor the US. So where does that leave us, and what is Europe doing?
Well, look, the way I would look at it is that Europe and the EU particularly lack the hard power characteristic of both the United States and China. And Europe has seen this largely as a weakness. And to some extent, that's true. I mean, when it comes to defending ourselves from Russia, for example, That is a weakness. That is a problem. We have to work on it. We're trying to do that. Now, the question is, to what extent is it a weakness when it comes to our relationship with countries in Latin America or countries in Africa? And so I think there was a way of thinking about this that was sort of became fashionable in the last half of the last decade, which is that our traditional concept of development, which focused on sustainable development goals, SDGs, and was supposedly altruistic, was old-fashioned, a thing of the past, because geopolitical competition required a harder edge. And because we often experience as Europeans that even though we had this, you know, supposedly more altruistic approach to development, it wasn't particularly effective. At least that was the impression. And, you know, China was also often more successful in getting the interest of governments, particularly in Africa, than we were. And so there was a push at the European Commission of focus going away from this more traditional, perhaps possibly patronizing approach to development, to a concept of partnership, which is more about finding the common interest, and perhaps a bit more transactional, and perhaps a bit more focused on physical stuff rather than, you know, health and education, for example. That's broadly describing the trend. I have a nuanced view on this. I don't think this was all wrong. So I do think that, for example, the idea that we should be less patronizing was a good idea. I also think that, you know, emphasizing physical infrastructure more could be a good idea. But I do think that we sort of overshot a bit in our desire to take the Chinese approach, as manifested, for example, in the Belt and Road Initiative, as the leading paradigm for how we should do development, to the point where we actually banned development from our vocabulary at the Commission and renamed the whole thing as partnerships rather than development. Again, not a bad word, but I think development, you know, if you know what it is, I don't think it's a terrible word to use, right? And so, you know, I think we may have gone a bit too far into thinking that, you know, we can't quite be a hard power, but at least we can be kind of no-nonsense and focus more on getting something back from these relationships. And if we are maybe more honest about what we want back from them, then countries will take us also more seriously. And, you know, we give them what they want, we get what we want. That's the sort of approach. And so I've criticized this approach because I think for two reasons. The first is that we have to be very careful that by doing that, we are just not just transacting with elites and making them happy, right? That's the main problem. So, you know, if this is about mutual benefit, if we are trying to get something back, you know, maybe these are votes at the UN, maybe these are secure supply chains, you know, this can very easily degenerate into let's just bribe whoever's in power to get what we want out of them. And I mean, that would be a big mistake. You know, the Cold War has many examples of how this has gone wrong, right? The West making a pact with the wrong elites, you know, financing big white elephants, corrupt regimes. I'm not saying that the Commission is trying to do this in the least, but there is a risk in the intellectual approach. And then the other reason why I think this is wrong, and that is something that has become apparent only fairly recently, I think, is that I believe that most developing countries want an approach to international trade and development that is rules-based and where, you know, there is a common set of values. And even though interests play a role, this common set of values is spelled out, possibly codified in trade through the GATT, the General Agreements on Trade and Tariffs, the WTO, and then respected. And I think the fact that Europe has traditionally been willing to subscribe to that approach is a strength. And that we have not completely understood, maybe when we made the switch in 2019, how important this is to the developing world. And so, you know, discarding that in favor of a transactional approach that is essentially about getting bilateral gain out of this relationship is going to weaken our influence. I think Europe is influential because we are viewed as less heavy-handed, less, more multilateral, and in a sense, softer as a power than the Chinese and, I have to say, unfortunately, than the United States now under their new government. And so I do think that European soft power is an enormous strength. And we should not be overreacting, in favor of another one.
That is super interesting. And I appreciate your unpacking the decline of colonialism, which is a good thing in terms of promoting people's independence and autonomy, and also the trade-offs between development and partnerships to make sure that we're working towards a global good and not just tit-for-tat sort of thing. In the next half of the podcast, I'd like to look a little bit more at instruments. Alfonso, would you like to come in and talk about some of the financing instruments you have? I know you have everything from lending to taking equity stakes. You've got a bunch of different ways to go in. You've already talked about capacity building. But if you could talk about that, and then also I'm going to come back to both of you about how the tariff environment, Jeremy mentioned the WTO. I mean, we're in a really weird environment now in terms of international distortions and how that might be changing things.
Also, Alfonso, say something about blended finance, because that's sort of the magic word everyone is using. People don't know what it is.
Yeah.
So, Rebecca, very briefly on your previous question about the role of Europe and how this is probably changing, and I will bring the instruments immediately. But you know, I mean, one thing that we realized in IFC, especially a few years ago, is there is, I mean, we need to mobilize private part of the 400 trillions of assets under management that are in the world, right? And you have most of it either in G7 countries, let's say, mostly in Europe. And the issue is, it is not just the asset managers, but actually it is the willingness of the companies that have the knowledge and expertise in Europe to really go abroad. And some of them have negative experiences in the past and they are reluctant to go. So one of the things that we were trying to do is to really help them going abroad. So help the Spanish companies go into some other markets where they have not been, that they are not familiar with, exactly with the same with the French, the Italians, the Germans, the Dutch, the Belgians, et cetera, et cetera. So there is a role that we had, that we tried to play in accompanying them into these new markets by helping them with the reforms that might be, is of course not for this specific company, but it's opening a market that will bring some foreign investment. And as a result of that, we create the right multiplier and externalities. No, and this link with the reforms that I was mentioning at the beginning. So that link between helping or trying to help the European companies going abroad, going to markets that they traditionally had done in a different way, I think that is useful and is a big different way of mobilizing capital from what we traditionally have done. So that's something that I think that is important. The Global Gateway that the European Commission has put together, we leverage on the Global Gateway, trying to make the most of it. But you know, I agree with Jeremy, we need to really go beyond and think beyond the transaction. So this is not just to give or to do a transaction in one specific country, one specific sector. So you really want to get an impact that is much bigger than that, no? But anyway, so my point is that I think to some extent the Global Gateway is a good initiative to reposition the European Commission and the European Union globally. For many years, I really think that the European Union has looked inside of the Union. We had the large vein, we had many things to solve, we had the single market, many things. And we forgot, to some extent, let me say, that the market out there was super important, especially in a globalized world like the one in which we are. No? So the Global Gateway is a good exercise to think differently, to think outside, and also for the private companies and the private sector in Europe to go abroad, as I was mentioning before, and to bring the expertise that they have to other markets. That's not only just about financing, it's about knowledge. No? Coming back to your question, so what do we do in IFC? How do we bring different instruments to achieve that? And this will be linked as well with my first part of the conversation, no? The new role of IFC. One of the things that our president did when he came was, guys, I want to link more private and public sector. We really need to attract the private sector. We need to all these solutions, all these reforms that we do, all these policy and regulatory reforms that we do from the bank side in the emerging markets need to be known by the private sector, because at the end of the day, there is no capital enough and there will not be enough ODA to mobilize and to fill in all the financing needs that exist in these countries. So we need to help them attracting private capital and mobilizing private capital. And that's why we created the Private Sector Investment Lab, which is a nice way of bringing together different parts of the private sector into a discussion, trying to identify what are the main constraints, why this capital does not flow, why this capital does not really go to emerging markets. And there are some obvious answers to that question that we may think, but we need those obvious answers to really do the reforms that are, or take action as needed. No? Let me give you four issues that came from the Private Sector Investment Lab, which are linked to the instruments that we do, or that we try to do. The first one is referrals. I already talked about it. No? Every single investor say, okay, I will not go to this market, you know, because I have regulatory uncertainty, because I have a policy mistrust, and I have bad experiences here and there, and therefore I really need to make sure that the rule of law is there, the competition is there, that the institutional framework is there for me to go. So very big thing. Let's go specific into areas and let's define a plan. Example, M300 in Africa. This is an objective. This is an initiative that the World Bank put together, World Bank Group, together with the African Development Bank, to really bring access to electricity to 300 million people in Africa. That requires many energy reforms. And energy sector reforms are not easy reforms because, we know that they imply many things that, you know, must be, you have a intertemporal, I would say, tension between the reform that you do in the short term and the impact that you have in the medium and long term. But you also need to mobilize the private capital, because all those investments that are needed to bring this electricity to 300 million people, you will never be able to do it with the balance sheet of the World Bank or with the public financing of these countries. No? So you need to mobilize. You need to, the utilities in Europe or anywhere else will need to be mobilized in order to invest in these countries to achieve those goals. So that's an example of how reforms can actually unblock potential investments. The second is creating what we call asset classes. No? So one thing that we realized a few years ago is that investors, they like to invest in things that thematically are well aligned with what they have, meaning, and this is I'm not just thinking on FDI, I'm thinking on also debt or even equity. No, so they like thematic bonds. I want to invest in green bonds. I want to invest in blue bonds. I want to invest in gender or social bonds. So by creating thematic bonds, you tailor the use of proceeds, so basically the funding that they provide, to a specific development goals. And that's useful because then they have a clear line of sight of where this money or their money is going to be allocated, to what extent, to what impact, to achieve what type of outcomes. No? So the creation of these new asset classes is important in order to mobilize all this capital, and something that we did the first green bond many years ago. Now we created the blue bonds because of the blue economy and all the things related to the ocean, fisheries, etc., water sanitation, that is critical. No? Third point, and I come to what Jeremy was mentioning before, the risking. It is obvious, no? I mean, at the end of the day, an international investor might think, okay, why am I going to pension fund in whatever country in Europe, no? Why am I going to allocate my capital or my investment to this emerging market or developing country when I can actually invest in treasuries in my home country? So what is the risk-return equation here? give me, I mean, is it really something worth it? Because at the end of the day, I have pensioners behind me or depositors behind me that actually they want their money back, and they want their money back with some certainty and with some return. So you need to bring all those potential investments into a risk return equation that makes sense. And there is where the risking comes, because of course, it is not free lunch to go into some of these markets, no? And here, what I think that there are two things that are important. One, information. There is a clear gap of information in any model, financial model, credit risk model that an investor might do when they want to invest in emerging markets. And that's why we disclose these GEMs, Global Emerging Markets Risk Data List, no? Which is collects anonymized information from 20 development financial institutions on default rates and recovery rates in the world, in emerging markets and developing countries, which is actually quite interesting. I like it when I saw it because it gives you a interesting information that for investors I think is useful to demystify to some extent the risk that they are taking. No? Of course, with many caveats, because everything has to be, when we talk about this type of statistics, with a distance. No? But still, the average default rate in the last 30 years was 3.6% in MLIS. You know, this is more or less a B3 Moody's rating or single B Standard & Poor's. So that's the rating we are talking about when we talk about MDs. No, on average, again, you have to go one by one. Second is that the default rate is much less volatile. So probably the volatility that you see on defaults in because the market is deeper and etc. No, in developed countries is larger than in emerging markets. But what is particularly relevant in my view, the default rate in low income countries and middle income countries was much lower than the implied default rates in the historical country sovereign ratings. So if you take the sovereign rating and you calculate what is the implied default rate that is actually in that rating for those countries, and what we actually saw in this database is that you have more or less between 5 to 10 percentage points difference. Give you a sense, low-income countries, the default rate is, according to this database, is around 6%. The implied default rate is 14%. Of course, there is a sample bias here because the GEMs has some information of the investments that these DFIs did, and probably is the cream of the cream and not what the sovereign rating brings. But still, the point is that even if it is the cream of the cream of these markets, what you have is that even in those markets, you can have actually investments with a much lower default rate historically than what you perceive ex ante that you will have, no? So that's an important piece of the risking, no? Because the risking is not only the use of blended finance, as Jeremy was mentioning, it is also the to have the information that can actually reduce the premium risk that I will charge or I will put in my model when calculating the net present value of whatever investment I do in the world, no? But the second piece of the risking is the blended finance. What do we mean by blended finance? Blended finance at the end of the day is, look, in order to create a multiplier effect on the capital or the equity that you put in an investment or the debt that you put in an investment, you need some what we call first loss to the risk dot capital. So basically, if I'm investing, as we have done with the European Commission in Ukraine, in a moment in which, you know, in the last years, where it's not easy because of the invasion of Russia. And the point is, okay, if IFC invest equity, you know, we can really have a multiplier effect that is quite big. But if we also have someone, donor financing, that can take the first loss of any investment that we do, we can bring with a second loss, and therefore we can multiply the impact because we read the risk any others that will come with senior tranches to the same investment, and we can replicate the same transaction many times. If we will have only our equity or only the equity of the sponsor, then you may have a one-off and that's it. So the blended finance, in a way, what we try is to use donor financing, which is not a grant, by the way, depending if it is the typology, but that does not need to be a grant. You can put it as a seed financing, as a junior capital, as an equity tranche, as a pari passu debt. So you can use whatever instrument you want. But the idea is, how do you use that to multiply the capital that you can mobilize from MDBs, example IFC, and on top of that, to bring other private capital that therefore you will be the risk in them big time, because they will not cover the first losses when they happen, no, or the second losses when they happen. So the multiplier effect of the blended finance is very important. In our experience, and IFC is the only MDB that actually publishes, is public. We publish in every single board paper the blended finance that we provide and the impact that it has. And that's important, because what we do is that we analyze every operation and we say, okay, you need blended finance? Yes, we need blended finance, because, you know, their risk return, if we don't have blended finance, will be negative. So basically, there is no way that we can do this operation. Okay, let's put some blended finance to bring it to a market equivalent rate, which is reasonable. And then we bring the capital that we need. So what we need is to analyze one by one, and we publish the amount of blended finance that is needed, and therefore the multiplier effect, which is on average 1 to 5 in countries like Ukraine. So for $1 that the European Commission puts, you can actually get 5. And that's quite impactful if you compare it with traditional way of financing needs, which would be, I put $1, I get $1. Here, no. Here, with the dollar that you inject, you can actually get 5 additional ones. You can mobilize another 5. And that's the key of the blended finance structures. One thing that is super critical, in my view, blended finance is a temporary solution. So you need to have you do blended finance because you want to create a market, because you want to find to help the private sector or solutions to move in one sector or in another. But you need to have an exit strategy. You need to make sure that blended finance is not going to be there forever. So European Commission or whoever is not going to put that capital. But you need to create the market, and you need to have a plan to actually show that this is a one-off, a two, or a short-term solution that will lead to a more stable and structural solution down the road. No? Let me just one more point, or a couple of points more, Rebecca. More emphasis on equity. I really believe that's part of our IFC strategy, especially the 2030 strategy that we are elaborating now. The world needs more equity. There is clearly an over-leverage on many dimensions, definitely on the corporate sector as well, not just in the public sector, and we need to strengthen the equity basis and the capital basis of many countries. That's the most difficult capital or investment, of course, because the risk is much higher, and the capacity to analyze what you are really getting or the covenants that you have is much lower. So basically, there is a role that IFC has to play, bigger role on equity, junior capital, trying to mobilize and trying to strengthen the capital structure of the private sector in emerging markets and developing countries. It's more catalytic, is where we will have the most mobilization, and therefore also the most challenging. No? At the end of the day, IFC is the largest institutional equity investor in MDs. We have a portfolio of close to $12 billion. No? And that's where we believe we can have a big role. And the last one is the which is also a big part of the new strategy, which is what we call originate to distribute. Originate to distribute, that doesn't need to be securitization, because we always link one thing and the other. No, originate to distribute is, at the end of the day, IFC has 5,000 staff in all countries in the world, in every sector, specialists in every single sector. So we need to make sure that we can originate transactions with some standards procedures and standards, with some standardization that can be distributed to the private sector. That the pension fund in Holland or in Canada, or the insurance company in Germany, or the banking industry, whatever, or investment funds in part one countries, they can actually see, okay, these are the renewable energy originations or investments, operations that IFC has originated and is looking for financing. That's originate to distribute. They know us. They all these operations will comply with all the environmental and safeguards that IFC requires, the performance standards. They are originated on the same way. They comply with all the integrity due diligence. They have the financial and the credit analysis that is required. I only need to your financing. I only need you to put money here, because, you know, the capital of IFC is limited. So we need to mobilize your capital. We will originate but we need you to invest. So that origination, originate to distribute, I think that will be at the core of the future of institutions like IFC.
That is super interesting. And you've anticipated a lot of my questions on MDB reform and how do we make more out of the capital that they have, because a lot of the criticism has been that they haven't been ambitious enough. And you've just outlined some wonderful ways, or at least some very interesting ways that that might be able to happen more. I wanted to come back to blue bonds and green bonds. Blue bonds are marine-oriented bonds, can also be wind power or things like that. And then green bonds are other types of sustainable finance lending. Do you think those markets are really maturing? Are they competitive with other forms of finance? Is sustainable finance itself sustainable, given a lot of the pushback we've seen in politically?
Well, I think they are, and they are important. So when we created green bonds in 2008, the first decade of the 2000s, at the end of the day, it's a question of where are you using the money that you get? So to do what? That's a green bond. So what are you going to do on the asset side of the balance sheet? No? Where are you going to invest this money? The key thing is to make sure that the use of those proceeds or those resources is really monitored and is really going to where you said that it was going to go. And yes, there has been cases of greenwashing in the last 25 years or 30 years that didn't help at all, definitely. Does it kill the instrument? No. I think that the instrument is very useful. And it's useful because it's a way of linking the saver and the investor. And you know, the savers, they want to know what their money is going. And they want to make sure, you know, that they are investing in something that is green, because the use of their savings is going to things that they actually care about, which can be renewable energy, which can be construction in an efficient way, which can be whatever you want to think about. Why the blue bonds came as well, or the blue finance, why we created this new instrument? Actually, it was when I was vice president in Asia for IFC, no? And we realized that actually there was a huge contamination on the ocean. Rivers, ocean water is a big thing in East Asia, big thing. Pollution, contamination. And we realized that actually there was a lot of interest of investing in products or in of mobilizing capital in a way to create the right incentives to bring money to these development objectives. No? So we created principles, a guideline, as well as we did with the green bonds on the blue finance, which is exactly the same. So give me the assets or give me the typology of investments where I can invest to actually label a bond as a blue bond. And it covers fisheries, it covers sustainable tourism, it covers water sanitation, it covers contamination or cleanup, etc. So there are many things related to water and related to irrigation and related to fisheries, tourism, that are covered by that. And by that, actually, you can mobilize a lot of money that actually is interested in investing there. And you can also label the financing of some companies that want to get finance to do things that are related to this. For instance, the other day I was in Ecuador, no? A shrimp company that is creating or using renewable energy for all the electrification of the shrimp factories that they have. Well, this has to be done in a sustainable way, et cetera, et cetera. This is a clear blue bond. It's a blue bond because all that the fishery becomes sustainable, okay, aligned to our standards, aligned to our guidelines, and they issue a sustainable bond. It's a good way of, again, of linking the interest of the saver with the, let's say, the interest as well, or the incentives of the investor. So I think that is valid. I think it's very useful to have these thematic bonds. It's a good way of linking. What is critical is that the monitoring of these bonds need to be super careful and super well done to avoid any misconception or any washing that actually will totally kill the reputation of these bonds perceiving that you are actually marketing something that is not what was supposed to be.
Yeah, it's really interesting to hear how this market standard has developed, given the debate within Europe about the taxonomy and how to prevent greenwashing. Having a really market-driven set of standards seems like a productive way to go about it.
And that's a big challenge, Greg. Sorry for interrupting. I'm actually discussed many times with the fund, with Tobias and his team, and Fabio. Because at the end of the day, you know, how many taxonomies do we have in the world? Green taxonomies? It's crazy. Every country said that. I mean, 3 years ago, I counted 40 different taxonomies. That's crazy, no? I mean, in theory, you will have one taxonomy so that people will know what they are doing, know what they are investing in, what they are creating, no? Anyway, sorry for interrupting, but it's critical.
It's a really interesting tangent. It's something that we in Europe are spending a lot of time thinking about. Before I kick it back to Jeremy, I wanted to ask you specifically about the Europe and Latin American resource partnerships, because this is something that in this context we've been talking about comes up a lot. So what do you make of them, and does IFC have a role there in facilitating?
I think that there is a clear link as it is between Europe and Africa. It's not more Europe and Latin America than Europe and other areas. So it depends on the country, depends on the interest of the companies, no? But what IFC is trying to do is to build bridges between one and the other, no? I mean, to give you a sense, 25% of the annual financing that IFC do, 25%, goes to European companies to support their operations in emerging markets. And a big part of it is in Latin America. For instance, but it is not, the money does not go to the European company, it goes to the subsidiary. But it's, of course, a subsidiary of the HQ that is in Europe. No, and it can be, I don't know, Guman-led businesses or Guman entrepreneurs in Chile or in Brazil. And this can be a bond that IFC enters as an anchor investor, a bond issued by a European bank with a subsidiary in South America. They issue the bond, IFC is an anchor investor, and we mobilize another investors that will come behind us because we are structuring the operation. It's what I said before. It's this effect of IFC structuring, entering as an anchor investor, and then bringing other investors behind. Has two effects. One, capital markets development. We try to do this in capital markets more and more so that we provide a little bit more of depth to the capital markets. And second, the knowledge thing that I mentioned before, no? So the reputation of, okay, it's IFC here, they have a structure, they are an anchor investor, it is easier to bring others, no? So, but others could be, I don't know, financing sustainable infrastructure in Latin America, no? The European companies on infrastructure, let's say utilities, energy, etc., or even basic infrastructure like roads, airports, the European companies are very strong. The issue is, can we help them to go into Central American countries, into South American countries to finance the hard infrastructure that is needed? Yes, that's what we try to do. We help them with the analysis. We help them with all the environmental and safeguards analysis. We provide them with some financing, and we help them to mobilize financing from other investors.
Thank you very much. Jeremy, what would you like to pick up on?
Yeah, a couple of points. And I also have a question for Alfonso. So generally, I think that institutions like IFC and also EBRD, which I worked for, are in this strongest imaginable position today because they are exceptionally resilient in their mission and operations in an environment where fiscal space is limited because they're focusing on the mobilization of private funds. They are also, if you like, ideologically resilient. So backlash against development or, you know, spending private public funds abroad, they are less sensitive to this. But they are particularly important for something that Alfonso mentioned at the end of one of his interventions, which is that we have a problem in many developing countries with sovereign leverage. So we have, you know, high debt levels in many African countries and several Latin American countries. And the official sector, when it tries to address this, often the consequence or the resolution of debt crisis results in substituting private sector debt for official debt. And the official debt that then gets put in, which is IMF, World Bank, is impossible to restructure. So you end up with countries with a lot of multilateral debt, which is sort of hard debt. I mean, you cannot get out of it anymore. And as a result, the whole system becomes less flexible. It is very unattractive for private creditors to come in because they're junior. And so the only way to get out of this trap is actually to go more with equity, like Alfonso said, and to do it sort of have development in a broad sense happen through private sector means, right? And so this is a really a secular problem, and it's not made easier by the fact that official debt restructuring, even bilateral debt restructuring, which is less difficult in principle. They are a little more junior on the pecking order, but it's also very difficult because of coordination problems between China and other creditors. So this is a really important point. Now, I have two questions, which is basically about the promise and limitations of both blended finance and originate to distribute. So on blended finance, I think that the beauty of blended finance is that it's, in principle, it's very flexible because it can help you with two sorts of situations. One is genuine de-risking in the sense that you have projects that are positive expected return, but they're too risky. And then it's great. I mean, if you have institutions that are less risk averse, that are more long term, more resilient, you put in the equity tranche, you make a ton of money in the end, and everything is fine. And you get the private sector in as well. But then there's, of course, another application which you hinted at, which is there may be projects that have, you know, positive social returns, but actually expected returns for the private sector are negative, but they may still be very important to do. So clearly, you know, renewable energy projects in countries that have very high cost of private capital, you know, if the cost of capital would be lower, they would be profitable, but they're not. And so, you know, at market terms, they have negative expected returns. Nonetheless, particularly rich countries that benefit from the emissions reductions should be putting some money in that and subsidizing them. And this offers an intelligence structure for subsidizing them. My question there is, how do you make sure that the donors do not overpay, right? So that in the end, since it's explicitly about filling a hole, that you do not overfill the hole, and then in the end, the private sector makes a huge profit and the taxpayers are screwed. I mean, whenever I get asked that question, my answer is, oh, IFC will just take care of it because they will select the right projects and tell the official sector, this is as much as you put in and you don't need to put in more. But I'm wondering your views. And my second question is on originate to distribute. So to what extent is originate to distribute like a silver bullet, because you don't need that huge fund to begin with? So basically, institutions like IFC just go out with their limited capital and they just sequentially do lots and lots and lots and lots of projects, and then you sell them and into the private sector. So you don't need to sort of have a big blending structure, a big fund ex ante. So how far do we solve that problem of increasing particularly climate finance through that model, and where are the limitations?
Great questions, Jeremy. You know, to the blended finance, I mean, that's a super good question because, and it's the same question that I ask, to be totally honest, myself when I came to IFC. I was at the World Bank, I came to IFC, and I said, okay, this blended finance sounds interesting, but how do you actually make sure that you allocate the right amount of money, no? And I'm part of the blended finance committee, so I learn quite a lot. And the thing I will tell you about the mechanics. So the teams need to come to the blended finance with the transaction without blended finance. So how the transaction looks like without any blended finance. And then they show you the financials, they show you the model, they show you the situation, and this is the return, this is the risk, this is how it will look like. And this is the development impact that this transaction will have. And this is the additionality that IFC has, and that's why we believe we have to do it. So they bring with the, let me say, raw transaction, no? Where they have to show all these things. Because remember, there are three pillars in any transaction that IFC has to do. There needs to be a development impact, and that's why we have the AIM score, which is an anticipated way of trying to identify what is the development impact that we are having. If we don't have development impact, it's out. Second, additionality. So there needs to be an additional role for IFC. Why IFC is needed? Leave the market doing it if actually IFC is not needed, no? So you need to prove that we are needed. And third, it needs to be financially sustainable. We have to operate at market conditions, no? We cannot go beyond below market. So with that, the team comes with the development story, the team comes with the additionality, and the team comes with how the financials look like without blended finance. And then based on that, they ask for blended finance. And we actually adjust the blended finance. Every single committee and every single transaction has a maximum. There is a cap. There is something that we cannot go beyond. And, you know, if even with this blended finance that the project is not bankable, then forget it. There is no way that it can be financed with private capital. You need to find another solution. But if it is within the parameters that are reasonable, we cap it at a certain level. And the certain level is the market rate. So it's what we consider that it is a RAROC, a return risk-adjusted return on capital that makes sense for this market, for this sector. No? So every single project is analyzed in according to those parameters. Second, on the originate to distribute. So the idea is precisely what you are saying. So the idea is not to, you know, let's originate, let's do put here $5 billion and then let's move it to the market. Not at all. It's exactly the opposite. It is, let's originate in a way that we minimize the capital that we put from IFC and we let others come in. So we originate, we distribute. Distribute doesn't mean, you know, that we need a package, that we need a pool of operations to be distributed. Originate to distribute is every single transaction that we would like to do. If it makes sense from a financial perspective to do it in a pool, we do it in a pool. But if it is a standalone, we'll be a standalone. No?
Got it. Let me stop here.
Thank you so much. We're going to have to leave it there. I have to say, I've been involved in a lot of conversations about MDB reform, and this has been the most useful one in terms of how can we really leverage these resources and put them to work as opposed to sort of, you know, talking about gearing ratios and other abstractions. So thank you so much for that. Thank you to, from IFC, Alfonso Garcia Mora, the Vice President for Latin America and Europe, Bruegel's Director, Jeremy Zettelmeyer, a veteran of this scene. Thank you to you, the listener. You can find all of Bruegel's work on this issue at our website, bruegel.org. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.